I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. That's me and my knife bag. For years, we've been inseparable. I've got everything I need in here. A chef's knife, a paring knife, a serrated, a steel, a rubber spatula, a fish spatula, a peeler, a corkscrew, fish tweezers, a thermometer, a microplane, tongs, an oyster shucker, and the absolute best cooking spoon in the world. 9 inches long with a flat, wide bowl that fits exactly 2.5 tablespoons of water. You know, the little things. The little inanimate objects that cooks come to love like they were actual friends. Just because they're made of metal, wood, and plastic doesn't mean they don't have rich interior emotional lives. This week, it's all about the surprising stories of the little tools in your kitchen. We'll hear from a bladesmith whose best career advice came to him in a dream. We'll hear about the world's greatest vegetable peeler salesman. And first, let me start with a question for you. What would you say is the most important tool in your kitchen, the one you literally cannot cook without? Well, sorry, it was a trick question because the tools we use, even the ones we absolutely depend on, are all cultural. And that means nothing is truly essential because cooks have been making great food using totally different tools than you or me since we climbed down from the trees. So Tim Hayward is a British food writer and an obsessive about the history of kitchen tools. And we talked to him about some of the ones people think they can't live without and about the ones that did kind of change everything. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Now, I love the idea that the tools we use say so much about us, often without us even realizing it. So the first thing I want to talk with you about is the chef's knife, because I think we think of getting a quote-unquote real chef's knife is, you know, what makes you a real cook. I remember getting my first chef's knife. It was $65. I thought, my God, I need to keep this for the rest of my life. Like, I'm a serious cook now. But you wrote that's a pretty recent idea. So how'd that happen?
I think it is. I think, you know, when you travel around and see people cooking in their own homes, and certainly if you think about your own sort of older relatives, there was no chef's knife, no chef's tool in the kitchen. They would use whatever was to hand and, you know, cut sitting down at the table towards their thumb with a vaguely blunt knife in that really worrying way. And I mean, it's a big, dangerous thing, a kitchen knife. I mean, you know, we don't have guns in my country. And when I put that thing on my table, I realized that that's a big, big piece of weapon steel I could do terrible damage with. I mean, even in sleepy Cambridge, if I took that thing outside on the street, I'd be tasered to the ground in 2 minutes. But, and yet we have this strange object. And that's a really weird thing to bring into your home. But I think really it just speaks a lot of the sort of the worship of the chef and how they started to become sort of celebrities in their own right. Elizabeth David, I think, was the first person in UK food writing who really said you should go out and get yourself one of these French carbon steel knives. But since then, I think we can't wait to see Gordon Ramsay doing that thing with the knife that he does on screen with the sparks go everywhere. I mean, the only thing you can be sure of is that's not his real knife, by the way.
You know, in my mind then, because this was such a fetishized object and because, again, this quote-unquote made you a real cook, I did sort of assume that people always cook this way, even though intellectually I knew, like, I didn't see my... Well, then again, in my family we didn't use them, but because we use Chinese cleavers. I grew up in a Chinese family, so maybe in my head I was like, well, we didn't see them but for that reason.
It's really intriguing how the knife almost tells you about the place of cooking in people's culture. I have a knife called a Kai Dao that I use, which is a kind of... I guess most people think of it as a cleaver. It's much lighter than an actual meat chopper would be. And I love it. I love using that. That's the general purpose knife of Chinese cookery. I've got a beautifully made one of those by one of the best manufacturers in the world. And it's still, you know, it's a $50 item. And you look at it and you realize that in that culture, it doesn't have the precision elements of a high status tool. It's kind of it's a thing that's kept in the back room. It's almost like a servant-like function that the knife is used that way, or perhaps that it doesn't have the status built to it. And you compare that with a Japanese knife, which comes from a tradition of samurai sword making, and there's sort of a nobility in the blade, And then you've got a German kitchen knife, and it's kind of, it's made the same way as surgical steel would be made, and it's sort of a, it's used by men. It has a male application to it because it's a tool and a function and near to a weapon. And all of those things, all of those codifications give you so much of a of an understanding of the culture of the period and the background and the way people interact with that, with cooking as a whole.
Yeah. And the fact that you have to stand up while using these knives.
Well,
right?
this is really weird. Yeah, I mean, the book started in my head, I think, when I started trying to write some stuff about the history of the fitted kitchen, because I couldn't work out why it was that we had this thing in our lives that was sold to us that was halfway between a room in the house and a piece of furniture. And there are two standard heights in the UK: one for the table you eat at, and one for the table you cook at. I couldn't work that out. And at some point around the period of the sort of the modernist designers, the Le Corbusiers, etc., they were thinking, oh, this is a working practice, the making of food. Therefore, you should have a bench, and you should stand at a bench, like, as it would then have been, a man working in a workshop. And so you have a rack for your tools, and you have a bench at waist height on which you operate. Now, that means that the chef's knife is absolutely useless without a chopping board. There are other parts of the world where people just don't have a bench. They cook around a fire. They cook around a pot. The standard working position is kind of squatting. And then you have knives where you cut either towards your thumb, or there's a phenomenon of guarded knives. You see these a lot in Southeast Asia. So it's like a knife, very much like a quick vegetable peeler, where the blade is concealed behind a metal guard. And you run it along the vegetable. And you don't need a chopping board to cut downwards and into it. And you can use it in any position, in any place, and you don't need the kitchen. It's a marvelous, marvelous notion.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I just came home from a trip in Thailand, and so many of the traditional kitchens in Thailand are outside their home.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Near the fire, and you don't want the fire inside. That's it. Yeah.
Right. It's a totally different space, and that transforms the tools, that transforms your position, that transforms everything.
Completely. Yeah. I didn't actually get any photographs of the device to go in the book, sadly, but this will really bake your noodle. In traditional Indian cookery, the knife is mounted on a wooden block on the floor between your legs. And you take the object in your hand and you kind of bash the object on the blade. It's phenomenal. It's bizarre and brilliant to watch. An entire reversal of the way that people cut domestically.
Yeah. There's no, like, one right way to do things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's move on to something else. Something else that in your book that I thought, well, that seems super innocuous, but you say are super controversial, and that is the garlic press and that, like, little weird earthenware pot that my mom keeps her garlic in.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, the role of garlic, this is the UK. Everything has a class ramification to it. We love our class system. And you know, we can't wait to find ways to distinguish ourselves from each other. But the garlic press was originally designed so you could squeeze garlic without getting the smell of garlic on your fingers. Smelling of garlic would have been a lower class thing. It would have mean you were either a cook, God forbid, or you were one of those people that had cheap, awful food, and you had to put this stinking bulb into it to make it taste of anything at all. And so I think, again, it was Elizabeth David who wrote first about this. You had this slightly scornful attitude, which is actually, you know, of course you shouldn't use one of these ghastly lower middle class objects. You must display your bohemian creativity by embracing the garlic and loving the smell of it. And so you must press it with the side of your knife and sort of mince it with salt and things like that. And even now, I think food writers and food people are generally quite quiet people. But if you want to start a proper fight in a pub, you know, talk to another food writer about whether or not they use a garlic press. I mean, I use a garlic press, but I'm not going to admit it to anybody at all. That's our secret.
Okay, well, Elizabeth David wrote in the mid-century, right? In the 50s, I believe.
That's right. 50s into the 60s, yeah. Yeah.
So she is talking about you have to love your garlic, embrace your garlic, you know, that many years ago. Why is that still controversial now?
I think because...
Why are you getting into fights on weekends?
Well, she, for me, as a writer, I think she symbolizes a period of writing about food in the UK that was very much about upper class aspiration. And I'm of a generation of food writers that doesn't feel that way. We have so many different varieties of food from so many different cultures, from so many different social levels. I mean, you know, I had something for lunch today that was the peasant cuisine of a country, you know, the other side of the world. And I'm proud that that kind of thing happened. So I think a lot of the class distinction that was in that period, we want to get rid of. We want to avoid that element. And so I suppose I probably use a garlic press because Elizabeth David said I shouldn't.
Then there are the little tools that you say kind of changed everything. And it sounds like chief among these are the clock and the thermometer. What do you mean?
Oh, boy. Yes. Well, if this ties you into the entire history of cookbooks and recipes. So peasant people cook for themselves by kind of heating up the food over the fire. That was all there was. And, you know, you passed orally the tradition of how you cooked certain things on. But it was only when you start having kitchens in great houses and you have professional cooks working there that you have to start having some kind of principle of passing the message on. So in stately homes, there were apprentice cooks. In monasteries, there would be cooks who would teach younger cooks who would teach younger cooks, always orally. But the minute you start having recipes written down, you've got to have a different kind of notion of time. So back in the old days in a monastery, I would say to you, you young monk, if you want to boil an egg, you should recite 4 Hail Marys. And if you want to cook it a little bit more, you go a little bit more than that. If you want to go a little bit less, because that's the way it's always been here. And that would be fine. Now, if I'm writing a book about how to cook an egg, I've got to be able to talk about a different kind of time altogether. I've got to be able to talk about a standard minute. And so the minute you have timing, you can actually communicate between each other over greater distances, and suddenly a recipe makes sense. And of course, it's exactly the same with temperature. It used to be that you would talk about a hot fire, a cool heat, and medium, which was right in between the two. Even thinking about recipes in the sort of 1940s, it would talk about, you know, cook over a fierce fire, cook over a light. And they were using the term fire, even though they had gas cookers at that point. But there were only sort of the two settings, low simmer, hot sear. And that was it. But also, in a way, I think that causes a lot of the problems, a lot of the issues that we have with food, this notion of perfection. This notion that if I'm a half-decent writer, I should be able to write you a recipe whereby, if you've never done this before and you have no experience of this whatsoever, and it's from an entirely different culture of yours, you should be able to do it perfectly the first time you try it because I've written it so well. And that notion of perfection, it militates against everything I believe about cooking and I enjoy about cooking.
Yeah.
You know, you or I would work a different way. We'd find a thing that smelled interesting and then probably spend 2 weeks finding different ways of learning how to do stuff with it. There's not a lot of time. There's not a lot of temperature in those things.
And so the clock and the thermometer kind of pushed us into the era where cooking became science.
Exactly that. Oh my goodness, there's a place for science in food. But it's interesting that the science is necessary for a particular kind of communication.
Yeah. Now it made us have to assume that the food is objective.
Exactly that.
Well, you are what you use.
God, I mean, so how deeply philosophical does this get? How quickly?
Right.
It does my nut in.
Yeah, it's wild. Thank you so much, Tim.
No problem. An absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
Tim Hibbard's book is The Modern Kitchen, Objects That Change the Way We Cook, Eat, and Live. You can find excerpts from that book on garlic gear, timers, and knives at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we get into one of the covered blades Tim was talking about, but in a way you might never expect. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. 10 or 15 years ago or so, if you ever did any shopping at the Union Square Farmers Market in New York, or if you worked down in the financial district, or if you just happened to walk around Manhattan, really, you probably at some point heard someone going on like this.
All you do, you pull the scoop toward your thumb, use your thumb as a stop. Everybody can do this. Put it in the other hand, run that blade over, and you make those lovely carrot sunflowers. You give those to the kids, they'll eat their vegetables, they'll think it's candy. Now, whether you're right-handed, left-handed, or like a politician, underhanded, when you peel a potato or any kind of fruit and vegetable, all you take off that potato is a thin layer of skin. You get no waste, you do it in record time. Everyone has one of these in their drawer. They take too long, grandma gets arthritis. She'll peel a whole bucket full of potatoes, carrots, beets, using just one finger with my machine. You come to an eye in the potato, you scoop it out, there's the scoop. And if you love French fries, watch this. Use that scoop, pull it towards your thumb, you're going to turn the whole potato into French fries in no time at all. Leave the skin on, they taste even better, and they're better for you. In fact, if you cook those without trans fats, wash them down with a glass of red wine, you'll never die. You'll live forever. Put it in the other hand, it's more than a peeler. Now it's a mandolin, a slicer. You hit that blade every time, you'll get a thin, even slice. You do apple for apple fritters, cucumber for cucumber salad. How long would it take to do that with a knife? Look, those slices are so thin.
Back then, it would have been a man doing that pitch for vegetable peelers, a legendary New York figure named Joe Otis. He was an older gentleman, always hunched down on his tiny stool with these buckets of vegetables around him, just covering himself in potato peels and flowers he'd cut out of carrots and charming everyone in sight while he was selling his vegetable peelers. You'd always kind of wonder how many peelers he'd sell, and the answer, it turned out, was probably a lot more than you would have guessed. He passed away a decade ago, and that voice that you heard before belongs to his daughter, Ruth Otis Laurent. Ruth, so that was incredible. You really do manage to make a vegetable peeler seem like humanity's greatest achievement. Do you even have a knife at home? Do you use a knife at home?
I have a knife for things that the peeler can't do, you know.
Which is hardly anything, for opening cans maybe.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So you learned to sell that peeler in that way from your father, Joseph Otis.
Right.
Who really has an amazing story. He's a legendary New York figure. Tell us about him.
Well, first of all, he loved living in New York more than all the other places where he lived.
Yeah.
Although he, you know, he started working in Manchester, and then he was in London. He worked on fairs and markets all over England.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to Australia. He worked throughout Australia. But he loved selling in New York. But he's been doing this kind of selling since he was 14, 15, since he left school.
Mm-hmm. And how did he get started?
Well, he needed money after the war. And there were bomb sites around Manchester.
Mm.
And people had
World
set
War II.
Up. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And markets were set up there. And he used to go, he had a job, I think as a kind of a messenger or something. And on his time off, he used to go to the bomb site. And there were men who became his mentors, pitchmen, we call them grafters in England, who sold all kinds of things using all kinds of skills to crowds of people. And so he was mesmerized by these men, and they were a lot older than him.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, one by one, they took him under their wings.
Yeah.
And he had a nickname, Joe the Kid, because he was the youngest. And he, you know, after not very long, he started beating these older men at what they'd been doing for years.
I remember seeing him on the street. And he would set up on this corner that was two blocks from where I used to work. And I remember you couldn't really see him. He was always hunched over, very low.
Right, that's right. So the reason he did that is because people are attracted to something that they can't see properly.
Mm.
So it would arouse a curiosity.
Yeah.
And also, when people are looking down at something, it just makes it easier to hold them there.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Crowd. Yeah, yeah.
So
and occasionally, he would look up and catch people's eye.
Yeah.
But no, he always worked low. One of the main places he worked was at Union Square at the Green Market.
Yeah.
Most people who've seen my dad, they say, "Oh yeah, we saw him at Union Square." And, you know, there would be this huge crowd and you couldn't see. There's no way you could see what he was doing because there's this huge crowd behind.
Yeah, nothing draws a crowd like a crowd.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I remember the moment when I opened up a magazine, Vanity Fair magazine, and I read a story about this person who sold peelers on the street. So he's covered in potato flakes all day.
Right.
By night, he would get dressed up in beautiful suits and hang out at the most Tony clubs and bars and restaurants. And
that's
he made
right.
a fabulous living doing this.
That's
and
right.
every single person who read that story in New York City said, I know that guy and I cannot believe it. So tell me about that.
Right.
He had this other life as
right.
this dandy.
Well, it actually it wasn't really another life. It
okay.
was... First of all, he went to work in those fabulous suits, which was one of the things that was so unusual about him. The only thing that he didn't wear were elegant shoes because you can't, you know, you can't
them,
walk. Yeah, and also, like, he did so much walking, changing spots, for instance.
Yeah.
And this, again, goes back to that tradition of these the mentors who taught him many, many years ago. Like, when you go to work, especially in the street, you dress well because you don't want anybody buying something because they feel sorry for you or anything like that. So when Dad even, like, he worked around Wall Street, you know, and there were all the wealthy stockbrokers, one of them pointed to him one day, you know, and said, like, you've got a better suit than I have, you know. So the elegant dress was really a lot of who he was as a salesman as well as going out. But you're right. I mean, he used to go to the Pierre Hotel, which is where actually he met his fourth wife, Estelle, who he adored. She actually passed away a year before he did. She was an artist, a very elegant woman. And she would be there with her friends at the Pierre Hotel. And people, you know, who had never met him before, but he was charismatic in a bar.
For sure.
He loved champagne. He loved the good things in life. And, you know, people couldn't believe, you know, that this is what he did during the day.
An hour ago.
Yeah. Or people would guess, and I wonder what he does, you know.
Yeah.
And the idea that he's just a street trader.
And so he passed away 10 years ago, almost exactly.
Almost exactly, yeah.
Why did you start selling peelers after he passed away?
Well, the main reason was that he passed away just couple of weeks after he got the last big shipment from Switzerland. And he used to import 25,000 pieces at a time.
Oh, wow.
So there were all these boxes, 40, 50 boxes stacked up in his apartment. And I knew that I could sell them. And so that's really when I kind of took his place, really. And he had said to me, he used to joke about it and say, now I've just had a big delivery of peelers. He says, you don't want me to snuff it right now, he says, because that's your inheritance. And sure enough, that's what happened. And so I didn't work nearly as often as Dad. You know, I was raising three daughters and they were in school and... So I have literally one box left.
Oh, my goodness.
That I want to sell, but I don't want to sell.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, a little less than a whole box. Yeah. So, and I mean, I knew the pitch. I knew how to sell it. But when he was alive, I was very reluctant to sell the peeler. And I don't know why now, but I felt kind of intimidated. And because he was so well known for selling the peeler and his whole, you know, his whole appearance and the whole package, you know, I didn't think that I could in any way approach that. But I did. And it was... It was very bittersweet, you know, every time I would sell, mostly in Brooklyn at the Green Market at Borough Hall. And as soon as I'd sit down, people would come and, oh, that, you know, who, there was an old guy selling it, right?
Yeah.
You know, oh, that was my dad. Oh, that was your dad. Oh, we miss him so much. This is 10 years after. They still, you know, say, oh, you sound exactly like your dad. You know, I had a good teacher.
Thank you so much for coming in, Ruth, and sharing your story and your peelers with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure, and I hope you enjoy the peelers. And
for the rest of my life, apparently.
Exactly. Thank you.
Ruth Otis-Laurent is the owner of the restaurant La Ripaille in New York, and when the weather gets warmer, she'll be out there selling the last of her father's peelers at the Brooklyn Borough Hall Farmers Market. If you have one of her peelers or just one that you love, you can head to splendidtable.org for a whole mess of vegetable peeler-friendly recipes. So after hearing Ruth's story, you might be considering a vegetable peeler-only lifestyle, but the chef's knife is still, for many people, a prized possession. Like I said before, I still have my first knife from 23 years ago. But you know who loves knives more than cooks? Knife makers. True handmade chef's knives are a rarity, and in America, there are really only a handful of bladesmiths who deal with them. Quentin Middleton of St. Stephen, South Carolina, is one of them, and we talked with him about what goes into the craft of knife making, and it is pretty nuts.
When I decided to be a knife maker, man, it was just one magical moment in life where I decided, yes, I want to do this. It's when I watched Conan the Barbarian, and man, hey, quit laughing at my dreams, man. Come on, this is my life.
No, I'm very serious right now. Conan. Arnold Schwarzenegger with long hair.
Conan. Like, so I watched the movie and it was like this aha moment. Like, I want to be Conan. Like, so after the movie went off, I took tubing off my swing set. I got a cinder block and a hammer and I flattened the hammer and I'm running around chasing my brothers like, ah, this is my sword. So after that, you couldn't stop me making bone arrows and aluminum swords and things like that. That's where the passion really started.
Oh, my goodness. Well, how old were you?
Like when Conan came on TV, I probably was 6 or 7, something like that.
Oh, man. As a 6 or 7-year-old, you went out and you took apart your swing set and just started banging on it till you got a sword.
Yeah, man.
That's incredible.
Oh, trust me, I got in trouble.
Okay, so you went from having these alarmingly real toy swords you were making, and then you eventually got into the craft of making real knives. As I don't know much about this world, but as I understand it, most artisan knife makers mostly make weapons, right? Like swords, hunting knives, weapons. How'd you get into making chef's knives?
My mentor, Jason Knight, he taught me how to make hunting knives and swords. Mm-hmm. And I was making that for a long time. And I had a dream, man. Like, Jesus came to me in a dream saying, like, make chef knives. And, that was like, I'm, like, at a crossroad, like, aha. After I got that idea of making chef knives, I made a long list of every top chef in Charleston, South Carolina. I called every last one of them, and every last one of them turned me down. I guess I was just the telemarketer calling them, trying to sell a knife. I was so disappointed, like nobody would buy a knife for me. After I hang up and waited maybe like a few hours, that same feeling or notion came back on me saying, call one individual back. His name is Craig Deal. He was mm-hmm. the executive chef for Cypress. And I asked him, can he help me develop a knife? So I took what I thought was the ideal chef knife. Mm-hmm. Or chef knives. And I took it to his restaurant, and I took it to his sous chefs and chef de cuisine and things like that, and let them try it and see what they think. And no one bought it. Craig basically kind of gave me the like that tough love. He said, like, these are nice, these are cool, but this is too heavy, this is too thick, this is basically a axe. Like something that I don't want to hear, but something that I needed. So he gave me some hints or some tips to saying like, okay, I want you to make this knife longer or thinner or taller or things like that. And from those tips, I made knife that he would like. And basically he told his friends, their friend told their friends, and we on Splendid Table talking.
So at this point, you've been making knives that chefs do love for years now. How do you design a new knife? Like, what makes a knife good? Aside from the quality of the blade, which we'll get to later, but like, how do you design a new knife?
Well, Craig Deal and his sous chef, Bob Cook, they are very instrumental in this. Like, so I would basically spend hours in their kitchen. I'm watching how they hold themselves, how they hold their knives.
Yeah.
And my mind is just racing and saying like, okay, what would make their job easier?
Yeah.
Like, if you're using this knife 6 to 8 hours a day, like, what can I do to improve on what you have now?
Yeah.
It took a few years to get it right to what I think is the ideal knife. So I basically research like Japanese knives and German knives, French knives, and I kind of pick from each culture, mm-hmm. from the research, the literal researching in the books, reading, and practical research from me watching and trial and error, that kind of got to the point to where I am now on the knives I'm making now.
When you were watching those cooks and you were saying, okay, how can I make your life easier? What are some of the things you were thinking about? Like, what were you looking at?
The things I was looking at is like, okay, like the knives that they're using, some of the knives are kind of heavy. Mm-hmm. Like, so I want you to use the knife instead of it using you. Like, an extension of your arm. If you take your arm out and point your finger, and you wouldn't think, oh, my finger is heavy. It's a part of you. So it feels sure. natural.
Yeah.
So from coming from that notion, like, okay, I know I need to make the knife light. Like, what other knives people like? They like Japanese knives. Like, yeah. So, okay, my profile of my knives are Japanese-ish, if that's a word.
Yeah.
And I kind of took the European handle. And my mentor, he makes this type of handle. It's almost like a Coke bottle that he kind of got from the Filipino machete. And oh, I've copied that handle shape for so long. So I put that on my knife. And now I have this little notch on the chef knife where your middle finger, when you do a pinch grip on your knife, mm-hmm. your middle finger kind of sits in that area. So it basically feels comfortable.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
very
cool.
Simple. Like, but when you grab it, like, oh, he really thought this out.
Mm-hmm. So as I understand it, you had to pass this wild sounding knife maker test to test the quality of your blades. Tell us about that test.
I was a part of this organization called the ABS. It's called the American Bladesmith Society. It's a organization that teach people how to be knife makers or bladesmiths.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different categories. You have your apprentice smith, you have your journeyman smith, and your master smith. So to get to the next level, you have to do a series of tests.
Yeah.
You have to forge a 10 inch long blade. So overall, 15 inches knife.
Okay.
And you have to chop through a 2x4 twice and still have a sharp enough edge to shave the hair on your arm. Cut through a 1-inch manila rope and put that knife in a vise and bend it 90 degrees without breaking.
That's bananas.
Yeah.
So like, your knives can do that?
Well, that's the standard that I'm going for, yes. Like, but I don't suggest it, like, because that voids your warranty.
Yeah.
Like, so you can buy another one.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. But that is wild. You know, when I hear you describe that test, the quality of blade, I think, oh, my goodness, that sounds so high tech. Like, you have to have, like, the most high tech equipment to make that stuff. But I saw a video of you working, and it looked like it was literally in your backyard, and you were taking this piece of metal out of a fire and hammering it with a hammer. It was definitely a Conan vibe. Do you still make every knife yourself by hand like that?
Yes, every knife that comes out of my shop that has military-made knife, yes, it's handmade by me and my crew.
So the two people you have working with you, small crew, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but you're also in a really small town, and it makes me, it just reminds me of these sort of legendary stories of these like Japanese knife makers in like Sakai City and, you know, these places in Japan where, you know, it's like a small village, but that village becomes known for doing this thing. Is that something that goes in your mind at all?
Oh, definitely, man. Like, my dream from day one was I wanted to build a factory and employ people from my community. That was my dream from the start. And like, even when I was making knives, like a lot of the people that I looked up to, they were kind of disappointed that I was kind of going into the production knife realm. They were saying like, oh, you have so much potential and you have so much to give and like you have it, but you're doing production knives. But like Mr. Ford and the Dodge brothers and whoever made the BMWs, like they all started in someone's garage or backyard. And in my mind, I'm saying like, why can't it start with me? Like, I have the drive, I have the determination, and why not? Like, I can do it. Like, so I've been making knives for 16 years, and my company's been open almost 9 years or so, mm-hmm. and it's going in the right direction. Like, so I'm blessed. I'm good.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Quentin.
Thank you for having me on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Quentin Middleton's company is Middleton Made Knives. Coming up, I get to talk with you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, let's talk, you and me. You can give us a call anytime. Leave a voicemail, 1-800-537-5252, or we are on most of the social media platforms of choice. All right, we have Melissa on from Cottage Grove, Minnesota. Hey, Melissa.
Hello, Francis.
How can I help you?
Well, I have a question. I like going to secondhand shops and vintage shops and antique shops, and oftentimes I will see this tool, and it is not always in the baking, cooking area. Sometimes I even see it in personal items, grooming items, but it is a comb-like object with a handle and prongs. And I finally recently ran into one of these that was actually in the box in a vintage store.
Okay.
It was a 1932, they call it a cake breaker. And I found mine and discovered, hey, they actually still make them. I could still purchase one if I wanted to. I was curious to know, do they work? Are they worth purchasing? Are they still a modern tool worth having? Or is this just something that stays in those antique shops?
I actually know what you're talking about. The idea is, okay, so like you described, it's basically like, it looks like a comb with really long tines, long, thin tines, probably with a little bit of a sharp tip at the end of them. And the idea is, especially for really delicate cakes, like an angel food cake, if you use a knife to cut it, you might crush the cake while you're cutting the cake. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you're going down with the knife. I think in most realistic situations in the modern day, you can just use a serrated knife, or if your knife is sharp enough and you're using a slicing motion rather than a crushing motion, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But the idea of this comb-like thing is you have these really long, thin tines, and what you do instead of slicing the cake is you basically poke your way down into the cake and then use it to sort of lift off a slice. So imagine your angel food cake is in like a bundt pan, right? So it's a ring, and instead of slicing off a slice, you go down with this thing, and then you just kind of like gently lift that, you know, that slice away from the rest of the cake. And because it's so delicate, it should rip, and then you'll have like a nice piece, and you won't crush the cake doing so. Yeah, that's the idea. But again, you know, I just don't know if that's big enough an issue for people to need this item, but that's what it was used for. And it is kind of cool and weird looking. It could be a cool, like, you know, conversation piece at your next
party. Exactly. I was even thinking, should I just have one on hand and play the game? What do y'all think this is for?
Yeah.
And then pull out my angel food cake and ta-da, see what it's for.
Ta-da.
And then we can play the game, what are other uses for this utensil?
Yeah, I mean, it does look a little bit like a medieval torture device, so like it might get, you know, it might get awkward really quickly.
Yeah, it could. You're right. Absolutely. Could go down the wrong road. Right. Well, this is super helpful.
Well, I'm glad. All right. I'll talk to you later, Melissa. Thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
All right. We have Matt from Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Matt.
Well, hi, Francis.
How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. It's a lovely day here in Madison.
Beautiful. What can we talk about today?
Well, first, I have to say I love your show, and I love the topic for this week's show.
Great. Thank you so much.
I have had this question on my mind for actually a number of years. My question is on tools having a detrimental effect. My family didn't really use garlic much when I was growing up, so I learned how to use it when I was going to school in England. And there, everyone diced it with a paring knife. But when I got back to America, most people used a garlic press. And so I've wondered for some time if the press somehow made the garlic taste different.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sure. It's funny you mentioned garlic press and also England, because one of our guests at the top of the show today has a lot of thoughts about being an English person and the use of garlic presses. And apparently it's tied in with class and all these really interesting like cultural constructs there. But I will say using a garlic press does do something that makes the garlic taste different, probably, than if you were to mince it with a paring knife. Garlic is this constant source of mystery and wonder, in addition to good flavor. And the thing with garlic is that all the compounds that you think of when you think of garlic that make that aroma of garlic and the heat of garlic are, you know, locked in cells. And the more you disrupt the cell walls, the more of those aromatic compounds will come out. So and what that means is if you have a super sharp knife and you slice a garlic clove in half, well, yeah, you're breaking a lot of cell walls, right, in slicing it in half, but it's rather clean. Like you're sort of limiting the number of cells that you're actually going to rupture by slicing it in half and then quartering it and, you know, whatever, however much you cut it. But the more you cut it, the more those cell walls will break and the more those aromatic compounds come out. So a finely minced garlic is actually going to taste and smell more garlicky than a roughly chopped garlic. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Interesting.
And what a garlic press does is it actually forces the garlic through these little holes. And so what you're doing is not even neatly cutting through the cell walls and rupturing the cells and producing and, you know, letting those compounds escape. You're crushing the cells. You're like mashing it. So many more cells get crushed and you get a lot more of that intense garlic aroma by putting it through a press. Now, sometimes you'll see instructions for making a garlic paste with your knife. And what that means is you mince it, you chop it, then you mince it, and you might sprinkle on some kosher salt, and you keep mincing it, and then you use the side of your knife and kind of mash it against your board and run your knife against the garlic. And what you're doing there is you're trying to essentially mimic a garlic press in that you're smashing all the cells open. So okay. If you are just chopping with a knife versus putting it through a garlic press, you probably will get a real difference in the flavor and the aroma of the garlic.
Well, that's great to know. I can see how it could be used in different recipes and for different situations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I wouldn't say better or worse. It's just a matter of like, what are you going for? And knowing how to get there, you know, then you can choose what you're going for, right?
Perfect. Well, that's good to know. I've always wondered that. Thank you.
Cool. Well, thanks for the call, Matt.
You bet.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Remember, you can always call us and leave a voicemail, 1-800-537-5252. One of my favorite things about Cook's Illustrated magazine, I mean, going back to the 90s when I first started reading it, are the reader's tips, you know, the ones they send in about how to find new ways to use tools you already have. It turns out it's one of Dan Souza's favorite parts of the magazine, too. He's the editor-in-chief. And he talked to Sally Swift about some of his favorites.
Hey, Dan, great to have you with us.
Always nice to be here, Sally.
So we have been digging into tools this hour, and we thought of you immediately because of this column that you have done for years in the magazine called Quick Tips, which is when readers send in sometimes bizarre alternative uses for tools. How long have you guys been running that column?
So that's actually totally original to the magazine. We've been doing it since the premiere issue back in 1993, and we haven't stopped. So we do it every single issue. We get tons of awesome submissions from all of our readers, and we test them in-house, see if we like them, see if they work, and then if they do work, we publish them along with an original pen and ink illustration and credit the reader. They're just a really fun part of the kind of Cook's Illustrated community.
There are great ideas. I have learned so much. And of course, one of my favorites is that wacky suggestion of using your washing machine as an ice bucket.
Yeah, I love that too. I've actually done that for parties. So yeah, that one's great because, you know, you can basically fill it up with ice, throw tons of beer, wine, whatever you want in there. And then when you're done, you just run the cycle and it drains all out.
That is hysterical. And some of them are ingenious. Can you give us a couple that you have absolutely loved over the years?
Yes, absolutely. So one of them that I love to use all the time is a really speedy way to cut a number of little round things at one time. So this is like grapes, cherry tomatoes, olives, and it's using basically two lids that you'd get off of kind of large yogurt containers, or sometimes you see them as like deli containers or takeout containers. So you take one lid and you put it down so that it's kind of facing up, so you have some sides on it, and you fill it with, you know, your let's say your cherry tomatoes, and then you invert another lid on top of that. So you basically have kind of sandwiched the cherry tomatoes between two lids, and they're held in place by the lip of the lids. And then you just take your chef's knife, nice long knife, and you go horizontally right through the center of those two lids, and you have everything all at once. So instead of doing individual little cherry tomatoes, which can be kind of pesky, you go right through the center and cut them all at once. So it can speed up your prep quite a bit.
Brilliant. And a great way to use plastic, since we're all working so hard on that. Right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yep.
What else?
So this is a really fun one that came in recently. So, you know, some people leave butter on the counter so it's always nice and spreadable. But a lot of times you just have it in your fridge and it's really hard. You try and spread it on bread and it tears and it's kind of annoying. Mm-hmm. And so this person came up with this really great tip of using a vegetable peeler. So on a hard stick of butter, use a vegetable peeler and take off these thin strips of butter that you can just basically just lay out on top of your bread. And it, you know, it softens really quickly on a piece of toast and you've got, you know, perfect coverage of butter from a really hard stick.
That makes great sense. And of course, the butter stays fresher in the fridge rather than having it out on the counter if you don't go through a lot of butter.
Absolutely. Yep. So you can totally leave it in there and then, you know, but you can still have spreadable, quote unquote, butter
exactly.
whenever you need it.
Although I do go through a lot more butter since you taught me that cultured butter recipe. I don't know if I should be damning you or thanking you for that.
Oh, no, that's great.
What else? What about with salad spinners? I've seen a couple really great things.
Yeah, salad spinners are incredible. Obviously, they're great for salad and herbs that you've washed. We also really like them for chickpeas and beans. So a lot of times you want to, you know, rinse them to get rid of that excess starch before you use them in a recipe. And there's tons of surface area so they can hold onto a lot of moisture. Go into your salad spinner, give them a few spins and you can get rid of it. You can also use it, especially for chickpeas, to spin off the liquid that they're stored in, which then you can use as aquafaba. I don't know if you've seen a lot of recipes for that, but you can actually whip that liquid into meringue to use in, you know, vegan applications where you normally would use a meringue. So that's a nice way to get rid of it there. So yeah, salad spinner is awesome for that.
And a great thing to do with beans, because trying to get them dry enough, if you're going to roast chickpeas and you want a little bit of crispy edge, they need to be dry.
Exactly. Yeah, it really gives you a jump start on removing that moisture.
What about rubber gloves?
Oh, so rubber gloves. So these are, yeah, if you're using like, you know, dishwasher gloves, you don't get your hands all kind of chapped in the wintertime. They have a nice kind of texture to them. And we found a really cool use is actually removing corn silk. So when you're shucking corn in the summertime and you want to remove as much of that corn silk as possible and it's kind of pesky, you can basically just run your hand down it if you're holding with a rubber glove and it just comes right off. So that's a really great use for...
That is a great idea.
Yeah, obviously nice. You want to use nice clean ones. But when you've used rubber gloves and they're kind of, you know, had their time, had their use, we've actually got this awesome tip where you cut them kind of crosswise to make these loops of rubber that you can use as rubber bands. Mm-hmm. So you can use them to tie sandwich bags up and all that kind of stuff. So they have kind of a second life as well.
That's a great idea. And what about sharpening knives? Do you have some ideas beyond a knife sharpener?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of my favorite tips that we've ever gotten, and I use it pretty much any time I go on vacation and I get like an Airbnb or a rental, is if you have ceramic mugs, which most rental places will have, if you turn them over, there's a rough circle at the bottom where it hasn't been glazed. And that is a fantastic surface for sharpening your knife. So you want to hold the mug upside down with one hand, and then with your dominant hand holding your knife, you want to drag the blade across it pretty much the same way you would on a honing steel or a sharpening stone. And, you know, repeat on both sides, even number of strokes, and you'll actually see some buildup of metal dust on that ceramic. And that tells you that it's taking metal off, that it's doing some sharpening. And just a few strokes on each side, you can make a dull knife significantly sharper.
That is a great idea. And knives are always dull at every Airbnb, I swear.
I know, right? They always are. It could be a really nice place and a beautiful kitchen, and then the knives are totally
exactly
trash.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to end with one of my favorite, which the writer Helen Rosner has kind of made her mark on Twitter with, a good use for a blow dryer. You know where I'm going with this?
I do know where you're going. Yeah. So this was a really fun one that we got in. So we talk a lot in Cooks Illustrated about getting poultry skin really dry so that it can crisp and brown more readily in the oven. And so this person took it to kind of the next level and used their hair dryer on a couple of chicken quarters, leg quarters, and just kind of going back and forth. And you can actually see the skin dry out pretty significantly or after just a few minutes of going back and forth. And then she went and cooked it from there. And she got something that was, you know, noticeably crisper and cooked even a little bit quicker. Oh, so I think that's a really fun, just kind of out there one.
It is really fun. And let our minds and our creativity be free.
I love that. That's so important in the kitchen.
That's exactly right. Hey, Dan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Allie.
Dan Souza is editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated. And that is our show for the week. Until next week, eat well, drink well, and tip well. The production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Danny J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our assistant producer, Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, Sally Swift is our managing producer, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.